Try some people. We're going to now chant the shloka again. Who would like to start as the leader of the chanting?
Okay. You sounded to me that you were chanting this to the same leader as the Chaita Dharpa and March members, but maybe you're going slow for us. So is that
how
you were chanting?
I don't know. I used parts of what I was doing. It's not quite the same. I don't think it is. I don't know what this is, this meter, and I don't know the correct, if there's a correct tune for it. So, if you want to chant it to something else, go ahead. Just follow the tune of the chanter. Who wants to start? Go ahead, Mama.
I went yesterday.
Huh?
I went yesterday.
Did you? Okay. Somebody else? Any other volunteers? We're all friends here, we won't laugh. Huh? Okay, I'll do it once, then somebody else. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Yasaya tunvaya jitadatascha te shabdhigya swarat. Tene brahmaridaya adi kavaye hu shanti yatsuraya. Vidam yata vinimayo yatra trisa kumrisha. Namna sena sada nirasta kuhakam satyam param vimahi. Go ahead. She goes to Harvard. She gets to the first. Practice, you know, then you do it enough times. And you...
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Yamhari Rasya Yato Nama Mitarasya Tishu Abhijna Svara.
Yamhari Rasya Yato Nama Mitarasya Tishu Abhijna Svara.
Tene Brahma Hirdaya Adhikavaye Muyanti Yasurayaha.
Tene Brahma Hirdaya Adhikavaye Muyanti Yasurayaha.
Tejo Vari Mrdham Yata Vinimayo Yatra Trisargo Marsha.
Tejo Vari Mrdham Yata Vinimayo Yatra Trisargo Marsha.
Damna Svena Sada Nirasta Kuakam Satyam Varam Dimahi.
Damna Svena Sada Nirasta Kuakam Satyam Varam Dimahi.
Now next, tomorrow, a few more people will try, different ones. Like this. People don't, I can give a lesson on how to chant. If you don't know anything about Sanskrit sometime, but it wouldn't take long. It's because everything is bound by rules, and if you learn them, it's easy. Okay, so we have discussed now, pretty much gone through to there's a paragraph beginning in Vedic literatures that is said that the Absolute Truth Personality of God is the chief amongst all living entities. I didn't read that, but instead for this paragraph I substituted in essence the section from the introduction. The Prabhupada talks very clearly about the nature of the idea of the Param Satyam and about the Supreme Lord, the summum bonum. Here you see this paragraph, the word. So we're just trying to, yesterday, to focus in on to get a clear idea of this notion of the absolute truth as that from which everything comes. This very, very powerful idea. Remember that when today, when people look up and look wonder at the skies and wonder about the origin of everything,
the theological explanation is always to try to explain how it comes from nothing. Today's Tuesday, and there's the New York Times, there's Science Tuesday, and there's always some latest discovery of science, which always tells you something weird about the material world. And then they always try to explain it in terms of evolutionary theory, because that's, you know, it makes sense in terms of evolutionary theory. Today there was a real problem because there are sponges, which formerly were regarded as very primitive, but now they've discovered that sponges have a gene. And the same gene is in the higher mammals, which has to do with the development of a nervous system. Or why would a sponge, which is very primitive and simple and very, very old, have, and it has no apparent nervous system, have in its genome a gene that's used for the development of nervous systems? That one they had to leave for later, but the difficulty is that the other thing is they're now trying to make a virtual E. coli bacteria, which turns out to be beyond our computing power right now. It would require so much data working together to make a virtual bacteria and all the processes in it, duplicate them in a computer, that right now we don't have anywhere near the computing power to do it. This is a very simplest microorganism, you know, one of the, so on and so forth. How did it become so complex? But anyway, then they give a theological explanation that it really amounts to the idea that everything comes from nothing. That's really when you say strict Darwinism, that's really the idea. Let us assume, let us leave God aside or anything from the outside. Let us just start with natural things and show how complexity can arise for nothing. Or in other words, how there can be information that just spontaneously arises. Information as distinguished from noise. Or order as distinguished from disorder. Now it's more fashionable to talk about information. That's the thing to make that plausible. It's really hard, if you think about it, that everything comes from nothing. There's nothing, and then there's something, and it comes from nothing. Well, how can nothing be a cause if it's nothing? I mean, it just doesn't compute. Nevertheless, it is a very important part of modern science. There's the notion of absolute chance, which is the same idea. There's new introduction of new there's the additions to the concreteness of reality, which has no cause. And I knew somebody who was studying physics and had trouble with this problem in physics because it's required that you believe this. And the professor's thing, his response was, you'll get used to it. But we're not getting used to it. But the whole thing that's going on now about intelligent design is really about this thing. If you ever follow the newspapers, you know, intelligent design was, was developed by Hare Krishna devotees, as far as I know. They were the first ones to really come up with it. Because I met Sariputta, I guess, in 1972. He had just received his PhD in mathematics from Cornell. He was in New Vrindavan. He was the treasurer. Well, he started out as the treasurer because they figured, he has a PhD in mathematics, we'll make him a treasurer. Well, he didn't. Mathematics is the least of the skills a treasurer needs. The major skill is to tell people no. You can't have the money, and here are the receipts. You know. So then I think they put him on traveling sankirtan because they didn't know what to do with a PhD in mathematics. Anyway, he showed up in Philadelphia Temple. And I had received a letter from Prabhupada suggesting that if I wanted, I could write my doctoral dissertation. I could try to defeat Darwin, and I just had no idea at that point of how you could go about it. Mm-hmm. And so I asked, you know, I found out from Sadhapura that he had this doctorate in mathematics from Cornell. I said, you know, this is what Prabhupada says. Do you have any idea how you could actually defeat Darwin? He said, oh yeah, Darwin's wrong. He said, I knew that before I became a devotee. He says, actually, most mathematicians know it, but they don't say anything because it upsets the biologists so much. And it was just like, because I had decided, okay, I'll accept on faith that Darwin is wrong. I have no idea how it is. And that's been so. And it deals with, and Sadhapuda's argument was based on what's called information theory in mathematics, which he was quite competent with. So here we have everything comes from something. It's the idea that causes are greater than their effects. And there are schools of thought that say that effects are greater than the causes. I think it's also a Buddhist doctrine, which is similar to modern nihilism in that respect. But anyway, so now we understand, however, that the Bhagavatam, the Vedas, they understand that everything comes from something, and that something has to be a special entity, being self-sufficient, being full, being complete, and so on, that it can be the cause of all causes. As far as the nothing school, when they say nothing, but then when you get into it, it always turns out to be a very complicated, potent sort of nothing with many interesting attributes. It does, it always happens like that. And even theologians will say nothing, but they'll put a capital N on the divine nothing, you know, and so on. Okay, so now Prabhupada has talked about this, now about this idea of the absolute truth, and he'll return to it. But now he spends a paragraph talking again about Srimad Bhagavatam. He tends to go back and forth. He talks about the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna, and then talks a bit about Bhagavatam. And sort of switches back and forth. So here, talking about Bhagavatam, he now talks about people who go to the 10th canto, and especially the Rasa Lila, and skip over everything else. He calls this the most confidential part of this great literature. Unless one is thoroughly accomplished in the transcendental knowledge of the Lord, one is sure to misunderstand the Lord's worshipful transcendental pastimes called Rasa Dance and his love affair with the gopis. This subject matter is highly spiritual, although it might not look like that. To this day, most scholars seem to believe that Jayadeva Goswami's work, what's it called? Gita Govinda is in fact a piece of mundane literature that was picked up by other people, just like we might think she loves you, yeah, 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 is about Krishna and Radha. Or something. He wrote a piece of secular love poetry, which is then taken up by Vaishnavas in their innocence and it's natural that they would think that, because there's only a few of them that, if any, can really understand this idea that there can be spiritual exchanges of feelings that are related to in some way but different from the material. this it has been misunderstood quite a bit. And he says only the liberated persons who have gradually attained to the stage of Paramahamsa can transcendentally relish this rasa dance. Here Prabhupada says something that really it is really for those who are the Paramahamsas. And this stated in the second verse. This Bhagavatam Dharma Projita Kaitavotra, this is rejecting all kinds of contaminated dharmas and is meant for those who are Nirmat Saranam Satam, those who are completely free from all envy, devotees who are completely free from all envy. And so this indicates the qualification. So here he mentions these here. Srila Vyasadeva therefore gives the reader the chance to gradually develop spiritual realization before actually relishing the essence of the pastimes of the Lord. So that's why the Bhagavatam is not arranged as we can see. It doesn't look to us like it's in any particular chronological or logical order. It skips around a great deal. But there is a spiritual order. There are reasons why this is here and this is there and that is there. And so one is really supposed to go through it in sequence. So that one comes to the understanding of Krishna's intimate pastimes after one has understood and accepted who Krishna actually is, that he is in fact the ultimate source of everything, the self-sustaining sustainer of all others, that he is quite different from us who are the jivas. We understand this. We understand our own condition of illusion. We have become pretty much free from it, and now we can begin to understand these confidential activities of Krishna. So because of this qualification that's necessary, Prabhupada says, therefore he, meaning Vyasadeva, purposely invokes a Gayatri mantra dhimahi. Satyam param dhimahi. Dhimahi literally means let us meditate upon this satyam param. This highest truth, let us meditate upon. As I said, it's in the optative mood. In English, this is conveyed by the word ought. In other words, I guess an optative means in Didi Lin, Didi Lin. A verbal mode when you are giving injunctions, Vedic injunctions, is called Didi, right? Stating how you ought to behave, what you ought to do. And in Greek has it too, it's called optative. And in English it's ought. That's where there's ought conveys a moral injunction. You ought not to do this, you ought to do this. So this is the dhimahi, let us meditate upon this param satyam. Gayatri mantra. Gayatri is a particular meter of 24 syllables, or sometimes it's 24 and a half syllables. But there's a famous Gayatri mantra that is chanted by Brahmanas. It's what they receive when they... And to chant the Gayatri properly, one, as Prabhupada says this here, let's see. This Gayatri mantra is meant for spiritually advanced people. When one is successful in chanting the Gayatri mantra, so here he's now talking particularly about the Brahma Gayatri. It's called what all Brahmins are initiated with. he can enter into the transcendental position of the Lord. One must therefore acquire brahminical qualities or be perfectly situated in the quality of goodness in order to chant the Gayatri Mantra successfully and then to stay in the stage of transcendental realizing the Lord, his name, his qualities, and so on. So there's a matter of realized experience. Krishna says this also, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, if you come to the stage of Brahman, the characteristics are there. Prasanatma means you're fully satisfied, you're at peace. You're at peace. No matter what happens, you're at peace. Prasanatma, Nasotati, Nakansati, or Nakansati, Nasatati, which one comes first. You don't hanker for anything and you don't lament. That's the material world, basically, people wanting what they don't have, lamenting what they've lost, and so on, and hankering. Sama sarvesu bhuteshu, one sees all living entities as the same, in other words, because he's past the bodily distinctions. And that stage, madbhaktim labhate para, then he attains pure devotional service. So, a Brahman means one who understands Brahman. And, so that's why this Dimahi is put here to indicate that. When in our movement, when we see what is called second initiation, one is initiated with a number of Gayatri's mantras. First is the Brahma Gayatri, which all Brahmins are initiated with, and then a Gayatri mantra, Guru Gayatri for the spiritual master, then a Gaura Gayatri for Lord Chaitanya, and a Kama Gayatri for Radha and Krishna. As there are other mantras too, but those are the Gayatris that are there. We don't speak them because they're not supposed to be spoken out loud. But that's what this word Dimahi indicates, this thing. So having made that point, which Prabhupada already made earlier in the end of the second paragraph, but in order to reach the very substance, one must proceed gradually by developing knowledge of the categories. And this verse that we are chanting here, it has this characteristic you sometimes see in Sanskrit poetry, that the predicates are given first and then the subject is mentioned at the end. You know what I mean by predicates? the qualities of something. It's mentioned janmadasi yataha, that from which everything comes. That which is anvayad itaratas charate abhigyaya, which is directly and indirectly conscious, which is fully independent, which gave knowledge to the heart of Brahman, which whose energy, by whose energy all, even the gods are bewildered, and so on and so forth, like this. And finally, who is this we're talking about? Satyam Param. There's the subject at the very last. The first verse of the Sri Shishastika prayers is like that. First thing is Chaita Darpana Marjanam. There's something that cleanses the heart. Chaita Darpana Marjanam. It cleanses the heart. Mava Maha Davagi Navapam. It extinguishes the blazing fire. You don't find out what it is that does these things until it says Param Vijayate Si Krishna Sankirtan. Oh, there it is. Sankirtan that does all these things happen. So so you learn all these effects, so to speak, all the qualities or all the predicates, and then finally the subject. So this verse is the same way. Param Satyam. And so first you learn all these things, and then you find out what it is really worth. I mean, you don't anyway, but you can guess. But he says it like this. So this is, he's saying the structure of Bhagavatam. In this way, it kind of mimics Bhagavatam going through so many different aspects of Krishna in so many different ways. And then finally you get to Krishna's private life, Vrindavan. Okay, yeah?
I just thought that kind of blew my mind, the idea that this first verse kind of mimics the structure of the Bhagavatam, because it seems to actually.
Doesn't it, right?
And now Satyam Param is more or less the 10th canto.
Yeah, Satyam Param, yeah, that's what he's saying, right?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah. It's one thing in your study literary criticism, you notice things like that. Okay, now we turn to the subject matter of the absolute truth again. So now he speaks glorified Srimad Bhagavatam. It is the narration of the Swarup of the Lord. Now you have the text in front of you. It's right on the board. Swarup of the Lord. Rupa means form, and swa means own. It is own form, literally. So it also tends to mean essence. His own proper nature or characteristic. The Swarup of the Lord, which is manifested by his internal potency. So again, really he's talking about the 10th canto especially. And this potency is distinguished from the external potency, which is manifest this cosmic world, which is within our experience. So here this idea of two energies. Prabhupada once remarked, when somebody said something is natural, Prabhupada said, there are two natures. And that's a really deep comment. That when we say natural or natural, we mean the nature we know is the external nature. And then there is the internal nature, which he says the his internal and his external potency. These two potencies. And the idea of potency is also important. When it said janma dasa yataha, when it defines Brahman, it defines that from which everything comes. And this is described as that the absolute truth has potencies. Something comes from it. And the example of a potency, and the word for potency is usually Shakti. Energy or potency. And when Prabhupada says the Lord is omnipotent, or as Prabhupada always says it, omnipotent. When he says the Lord is omnipotent, he means to say, in a way that probably would never occur to anybody in the West that use it, that he has many, many energies, which have names. He had those names. Because it is said that the Lord's energies are one, yes, but it works in different ways. And so they're specifically mentioned three main energies, which are called internal, antar anga shakti. Antar means inside branch potency, and the other is Bahiranga Shakti. little hyphen. Bahir means external. The inside part and the outside part. And this inside energy, the internal potency, is that potency which manifests the entire spiritual nature, of which we are sadly unaware. And the Vaidhyaranga is the manifestation of this external potency, which is composed Chi Sarada, of the three modes of material nature. And then there's the third, Tatashta. Tata means the bank of a river or a stream or a lake. That part which is sometimes wet and sometimes dry. As in Stami is situated, so if you think of marginal potency, borderline potency, which is the jivas. So these are the three major potencies. Then the internal potency again, Vladini, Samvits, then they're further broken down and turn to be many, many kinds of potencies and so on. Like this, but these are the energies. The absolute truth has energies. The strict meaning of Mayavada philosophy is that the absolute truth has no energies. If you read the discussion in the Chaitanya Charitamrita of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's encounter with the sannyasis of Benares, who are Prakasananda Saraswati, who are Mayavadis. It's stated very clearly in the text, and Prabhupada makes it clear that Shankaracharya denies the energies of the Absolute, even though the Absolute is defined as that from which everything comes. Shankaracharya really says it doesn't. He has a very clever way of dismissing that second. He doesn't do it right there, he does it later on. We don't need to get right now into how he does it, but he denies the energy of the Lord. It's consistent. If the absolute truth is not a person, then the absolute truth has no energies. Now, people, there are many Mayavad philosophers who claim to be conveying Shankaracharya who don't say this because it's really brutal. It says you and I and this whole world around you really doesn't exist. It's not there. Whereas Bhagavatam goes at pains in the very first thing, to deny this idea, because this tree sarga is amrisha. Amrisha means not false. It's factual, or as Prabhupada says here, almost. How does he translate it? Almost factual. It is not false. It's not the real reality, but it's nevertheless, it's there. Just like a dream may not be real, because we think of what happens in the dream as really happening. It doesn't. It happens in the dream, but as a dream, it happened. It wasn't that nothing happened. It's a real dream. So there is a real illusion that takes place. But actually, Shankaracharya, he really says this. It's very uncompromising, and most people forget that part. I tried to. They're very inconsistent, actually. But Yeah, so here we are dealing with the potencies of the Lord. And Vyasadeva, he says, makes a clear distinction. Oh, yeah, we're talking about this concept of potency. The example that we see in this world of potency is, for example, because we see that things in this world has potency, like the sun. The sun's potencies are heat and light. So there's the sun, or fire, has heat and light. It has its particular energy, its potencies, or its energies. So in a similar way, there's the absolute truth, and this world is at least one of his energies, or two really. The jivas are here, although we don't see them. They're here and not there, at least a bunch of us. The internal potency right now, we don't know about. There is another nature, but we don't know about that nature. So here he says they're clearly distinguished in this verse. Srila Vyasadeva says herein that the manifest, now let's use the word, the manifest internal potency is real, and the external manifested energy in the form of material existence is only temporary and illusory, like the mirage in the desert. So here he's explaining that the example is given here, this yatra, because of him. Yatra means because of him, this subject of the sentence, Satyam Param, this Trisarga, this material creation, Amrisha, Amrisha means factual. Mrisha means, false. So it's Amrisha, it's factual, or as Prabhupada says, clear is factual, because the example is given, Tejo Vari Nidam Yata Dinimayaha, in the same way that the example is given of mirages. You may see fire in water. In other words, sometimes the sunlight reflects on water, and it looks like the water is fire. The water is not fire, it's water. But still, why does it appear like fire? Because somewhere else there is a fire. If there were no fire, even the appearance couldn't be there. So that it's a kind of reflected reality, like a mirage. Or we sometimes see water on earth. You see that when you're driving in the highway and there's heat and it looks like the asphalt is a lake. And of course, and sometimes in the sky you will see a mirage like that. So in this way, the different elements of earth, water, they appear as one another. This vinimaya means like transformed or interchanged. But if the water looks like fire, it's because there's a real fire. So this world. Appears to us as substantial only because it is connected with and somehow or other reflects what is substantial. It's insubstantial, like a dream, but still the dream has this reality because it imitates something that's there. That's what it's saying here. The demigods are bewildered about him, and the temporary creations they are bewildered, and the temporary creation appears factual, even though it's like a kind of it's a reflection of the original. and beyond Dhamna Srina Siddhan Nirasta Kuhakam. And he exists self-sufficiently always in his dham, which is Nirasta Kuhakam, free from all bewilderment or illusion. So here, that's where this beyond the illusory potency means the internal potency. So that's distinguished really clearly here. This is a place where even the demigods are bewildered. Bigger brains than us, and they're still not, don't get it. But there's another place where there is no Nirasta Kuhakam. There is no bafflement in any way.
I had a question about the that argument, and I think I always thought it was a really compelling argument, and for what it's worth, so did my philosophy teacher, that again, Shankar, that if there's going to be an illusion, rescue previous experience of reality, because if not, there's no foundation for the illusion.
Right.
So my question is about that argument. Must the individual who's in illusion have him or herself previously experienced reality to be an illusion, or must there just be a reality that's out there? Because it seems to play into questions about the soul.
Prabhupada seems to indicate that he must have had previous experience, doesn't he? At least that's his... He mentions a gold mountain. You have an idea or an illusion of a gold mountain in the dream. You have seen a mountain, you have seen gold. Mm-hmm. And you put it together, so there's some previous experience. Could somebody put an illusion in your head of something that you have no... I don't think you'd even comprehend. It has to be based on experience.
It must be reality.
Yeah, there must, yeah.
It seems to have serious implications.
Right? Yeah, I think so. Let's take a little break. 5 minutes. The bathroom here doesn't work, but there's one on the other side if you care to hike in the rain. And here we take a little break, and then we'll keep going further into the downtown.
I think Prabhupada also mentioned about using the dreams. It's been a long time. I don't remember about flying in a dream.
About what?
Flying in a dream.
Who?
If you're flying in a dream, but you've never experienced it, that can be used as an argument.
We have the experience of flying. It's called falling. It's for a minute there. What's happening with you? Why have you got a son? My sister's having a problem.